Welcome to New World Newts, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, Ralph Nader and Chris Hedges agree that the system is rotten, nonviolent revolution is imperative, and Bernie Sanders is doing more harm than good. Sound interesting? I hope you'll stay tuned. Fall is just around the corner. I have seen the infallible harbinger of fall, which is advertisements for back-to-school sales. Judging from the ads, what the girls need to go back to school is new clothes, a new telephone, and more new clothes. And apparently what the boys need is a new computer, new telephone, new widescreen TV, new Xbox game system, Blu-ray video discs of numerous popular movies, and the occasional article of clothing. No kidding, Best Buy advertises televisions in its back-to-school circular. Actually, my own son is going off to college, and the two of us are just back from a big box store, not unlike Best Buy. We emerged one laptop computer richer and several hundred dollars poorer. No new widescreen TV for this college student, though. Since he survived 18 years without a TV in the house, he'll probably survive another four. I'm getting ready for college, too. I teach a couple sections of freshman composition. There's a marvelous essay about teaching freshman English from the Atlantic Monthly in 2008. It's titled In the Basement of the Ivory Tower by Professor X. It's on the Atlantic's website if you'd like to read a copy. Anyway, that's where you'll find me, in the basement of the Ivory Tower. And trust me, the view from the parapet is much nicer than the view from the basement. My freshman students seem to be much influenced by a poem by Thomas Gray, or at least by one line of the poem. The line is, "Where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise." It's not only folly, it's work. Better put off the pursuit of wisdom to some more auspicious time. One's deathbed, perhaps. For it is written that freshman year is to be devoted to music, alcohol, reveling in newfound freedom, watching sports as spectators, and, for the boys, continuing their noble quest to lose their virginity. Maybe for the girls, too. I don't know. I've given up trying to understand youth culture. I'm going on about what passes for college life, not only because fall is coming, but because Ralph Nader and Chris Hedges talk about it a little too, and we'll soon hear their conversation. Chris Hedges' son also is in college, in France. In France, college tuition is free. Hedges notes that if French universities tried to charge students $50,000 a year to attend, the students would take to the streets and bring down the government. France also has national health care, paid vacations, paid maternity leave, and good bread. That's the difference between civilization and capitalism allowed to run amok. Chris Hedges and Ralph Nader, two important progressive writers and activists, and each has at least some local roots here in Connecticut. Nader grew up in Winsted, just a bit northwest of Hartford. And Hedges attended a prep school near here, Loomis Chafee School in Windsor. Nader has a weekly radio show out of station KPFK in Los Angeles. On July 11, 2015, his guest was Chris Hedges. We'll hear parts of their conversation. They discuss class war, the necessity of nonviolent revolution, and why Bernie Sanders is hurting the cause by working within the corrupt and corporate-controlled Democratic Party. And they discuss the oppression of young people by the elite through crippling college debt and the destruction of jobs, among other mechanisms. They agree that radical change is needed, and that the change has to come from pressure from outside the system. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren can't change the system. 200,000 people in the streets might change the system. Here's Ralph Nader speaking to Chris Hedges.
Today, who would you advise, a young person today who really is fed up, huge student loans, unemployment, globalization taking away his or her future, the varieties of mistreatment of Wall Street, this young generation of Americans that they've robbed of any kind of possible, even material emulation with their parents' middle class status? What would you advise these people, especially after the Occupy Wall Street and its encampments around the country was terminated in 2011?
Well, that's who I wrote the book for. And if there are two fundamental or maybe three fundamental messages of the book, the first is that with unfettered, unregulated capitalism, what's been done to the poor in this country, where they are in essence being forced to pay for their own subjugation. We see that in St. Louis County, where 30-40% of municipal budgets come from ridiculous fines and fees imposed on the most vulnerable. So that there's nothing left now to protect the underclass, the working poor, increasingly the middle class. We are seeing this writ large in Greece. The poor and the working poor in this country are experiencing what the Greeks experience because it's the same system of global capitalism. And this is not about rational economics or rational government. What's happening in Greece, like what's happening in the United States, is class warfare. It is a political reconfiguration to create a rapacious, unchecked, obscenely wealthy, all-powerful oligarchic elite and strip the citizenry of not only the right to protect themselves, but ultimately even the right to earn a wage that has dignity and any kind of independence from the system itself. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that when you rebel, as the Greeks are attempting to do, these forces will become very vicious. And we will see in Greece, I expect, what we saw in 1973 in Chile under Salvador Allende, who also challenged international finance, the international banking and financial system, and the political elites that work on their behalf created bread lines and fuel shortages and power outages and chaos, in essence, in order to bring the Allende government down. They will do the same thing in Greece. We have seen the Greecification of the poor and the working class. There's certainly an assault underway on the middle class. Should the world's financial system collapse again, which I think at some point is inevitable, I'm not an economist, but certainly many sober economists feel that because Wall Street has gone back to doing what they did before 2008, that's coming, then you will see the same kind of harsh measures imposed writ large throughout the United States. And that's one of the reasons why I did so many interviews in prisons. Figures like Jeremy Hammond, Bamiyo Abu-Jamal, I was with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and that's why the book is called Wages of Rebellion. You have to understand the cost, that when you actually rise up, these forces have very frightening mechanisms of control, not only in terms of financial and political control, but ultimately in terms of coercion. You see it on the streets of American cities where an estimated 2 citizens a day, most of them unarmed, are being shot and killed by militarized police. They will use everything at their disposal, and it will be ugly, and it will be hard, and it will be difficult. And I guess the third major point of the book is that there is a moral imperative to rising up against these forces outside of the certainty of success.
Okay, now describe this resistance in 2 ways. One, what's going on now that you think is constructive resistance around the country, even in localities, if not nationally visible? And what strategy, what specific strategy? Because you're pretty much a advocate of nonviolent civil disobedience, open civil disobedience. So what do you think is going on today that's heartening? And what strategies would you recommend so that the level of resistance becomes more impactful?
Well, I'm for nonviolence because revolutions are fundamentally nonviolent, and that's why I wanted to characterize the American Revolution as a colonial overthrow, where violence is often effective, as it was in Algeria and other colonial struggles, to overthrow a dominant oppressor that comes from the outside. But revolutions, the Russian Revolution, the Iranian Revolution, the revolutions in Eastern Europe, are about appealing to the centers of power. They are internal conflicts. Even the French Revolution, and as the great theorists of revolution, Crane, Brinton, and Jeffrey Davies pointed out, who I quote in my book, no revolution has succeeded until significant portions of the internal security apparatus has either defected to the side of the revolutionaries or refused to defend a discredited power elite. That was true in Iran under the Shah, under Somoza, anywhere else.
You're talking about the police and the armed forces refusing to defend the entrenched regime.
Sure. I mean, the Iranian armed forces were arguably the fifth largest in the world, completely equipped with the most modern weapon systems capable and, you know, available at the time. And, of course, they laid down their guns once the Shah fled and pledged their loyalty to Ayatollah Khomeini. And that was true. That's how revolutions work. So nonviolence, not only because I know the poison of violence as a war correspondent, but also because that's the only mechanism that will make successful revolt possible. And what we see now, we are seeing the brush fires of revolt, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's the movement to raise the minimum wage to 15, which you were a very early proponent of, whether it is the anti-fracking movement. There are a series of movements, many of which I think were spawned or certainly influenced by the Occupy movement, which don't receive much coverage, but which are very important. And it's always the state that determines the configurations of rebellion. The inability of the state, the corporate state, to impose internal limits, the absence of external limits, means that they will push and push and push, as we have seen in Greece, until there's finally blowback. And if we undergo another meltdown, which unfortunately seems extremely possible, then you will see blowback and you will see the state use everything at its means to protect and defend itself. And at that point, it will probably be pretty naked forms of coercion.
Let's take a specific year. We have millions of graduates of universities and colleges burdened by a total of $1.3 trillion in debt. That's even more than credit card debt. In Western countries, students don't have college debt, except for recent years in England. College universities in Western Europe are like high schools. There is no tuition. And so they graduate without these huge burdens. But in the U.S., you have millions of young people now, the millennial generation, as it's called, in their 20s and early 30s, burdened by these monthly payments at horrendous interest rates, whether to companies like Sallie Mae or even to the Department of Education, which makes a profit off student debt. What strategy would you give? There are certain movements here within the student debt phenomena for Jubilee. In other words, you forgive part or more of the debt, and they want to do that by taxing Wall Street stock bond derivative transactions, which are not taxed, unlike our sales tax in stores around the country. So they want to tax Wall Street. This is Senator Elizabeth Warren wants to tax Wall Street and wants to do something about student loans. So you're advising millions of young people. What would you say they should do?
Well, I wouldn't wait for elected officials to help you, because we've seen with elected officials, they have created all sorts of mechanisms to make sure that you will be burdened with that debt until the day you die. Mm-hmm. Even if you declare bankruptcy, student debt is exempt. It just accrues interest. And as you pointed out, interest rates are often higher than if you'd taken the money directly from a bank. These universities and colleges have been jacking up their prices at exorbitant rates. They have been, I think, very dishonest with the student body, telling them that taking out these kinds of loans is an investment which will be repaid once they get into the workplace. They are getting into the workplace. They are finding there is no place for them. There are no meaningful jobs. At best, they are working at a subsistence entry-level position, barely able, as you point out, to pay back these incredible sums of money, tens of thousands of dollars. And I would argue that, like Black Lives Matter, like the movement to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, there have to begin mass protests. My son, Thomas, who you know, did his graduate work in France, and I said, if you told French university students that they had to pay $52,000 a year to go to university, they would shut the country down. And I think that's precisely what has to be done, that students have to mobilize. Unfortunately, while they're in those institutions, the institutions who I hold complicit are not honest, because in order to push or seduce students into borrowing that kind of money, they may have to maintain this fictitious line that it's all going to be paid back to them. What we've seen among that dispossessed class of university graduates is the rise of what Bakunin called déclassé intellectuals, which Bakunin, I think, correctly pointed out were vital to any revolutionary movement. That's largely the Occupy movement was driven by white sons and daughters of the middle class who got out of college and realized there was no room for them, no place for them in the society, and therefore began to ask the kind of questions they were not asking in college.
The problem with the student loans is while the students are in college and university, they don't have to pay. And so they're lulled into this incredible indebtedness, and that's where they can really connect with one another. They have their own campus, their own newspapers. So when they get out and they become graduates, they're all scattered. They don't have a way to gather. So the question is...
And they're also, you're right, and it's not just that they're lulled, but these institutions feed them this line that this is an investment that's going to pay off. I was up speaking at Columbia Journalism School a couple years ago. There are no journalism jobs. Columbia Journalism School, the tuition is $36,000 a year. And I said to friends of mine who are teaching there, I said, where are they going to work? And they started saying on the internet. I said, there aren't jobs that pay on the internet. But these schools, like Columbia Journalism School, are not going to perpetuate themselves unless they become complicit in pushing this propaganda.
You know, they got to start street protests, just like in the minimum wage.
Right.
They know how to.
Right.
The millennials know how to connect with each other. It's not as easy as being on campus where you have auditoriums and bulletin boards and all the rest. But they really can do it, and they've got to really get going on this because there are millions of people, and they're increasingly getting a larger share of the vote, and they would get very good publicity. I read your book, The Death of the Liberal Class, a few years ago, and I just looked at it again, Chris, and I have to accuse you of an understatement. I think it's worse than even you pointed out. And before we get questions from...
That's a rare critique of anything I've ever written.
Before we get to some questions from David and Steve, because they read your books and they'd love to ask you some questions, give me the update on the death of the liberal class and how they totally abhor any kind of progressive movement in this country deliberately in the form of the captive Democratic Party.
Well, it's not. And I think that's a point I tried to make in the book. It's not really a liberal class. Figures like Clinton and Obama are not liberal figures. In Europe, the Democratic Party would be a far-right party. It's neoliberalism masking or disguising itself as liberalism. So you have all these self-identified liberals cheerleading George W. Bush's war into Iraq. You have self-identified liberals endorsing a system of neoliberal economics which is anti-Keynesian. I mean, anti-anything that is defined as traditional liberalism. So it's a faux liberalism where they speak in that traditional feel-your-pain language that liberals have done, but assiduously serve corporate power. And I think you've done as much as anyone to expose that.
Tell me about your take on Bernie Sanders. I mean, he wants to break up the New York banks. He wants to tax Wall Street transactions. He wants to really regulate drug prices. He's for full Medicare for all, everybody in, nobody out, free choice of doctor and hospital. He wants to get rid of these corporate tax havens. He's pushing for $15 minimum wage. He wants stronger labor unions. What's not to like? What's your take on Bernie Sanders getting huge audiences, much bigger than Hillary's at this point, as he pushes his candidacy for president under the Democratic Party?
Because he did it within the Democratic establishment. So he's lending credibility to a political party which is completely corporatized and shouldn't have any. He has agreed that he would endorse the candidate, which, you know, unless there's some miracle, will probably be Hillary Clinton. So what he does is he takes all of that energy, he raises all of these legitimate issues, and he funnels it back into a dead political system so that by April, it's over. That was the role of Van Jones. Remember, in the last election, running around using the language of Occupy the vote, and that's what Bernie has done. I don't understand. He fought the Democratic establishment in Vermont his entire career. Now he's sold out to it. Bernie has also not confronted the military-industrial complex at all. on a personal level, having spent 7 years in the Middle East, I'm just not willing to forgive him for abandoning the Palestinians and giving a carte blanche to Israel. He was one of the 100 senators, the complete Senate that stood up like AIPAC wind-up dolls and approved Israel's slaughter last summer, 51-day slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza who have no army, navy, artillery, mechanized units, command and control. So we need independent candidates, and of course that's why I was a strong supporter of your independent runs. That's why I voted for Jill Stein in the last election. But they have to be outside the system, and we have to begin to build movements that are divorced from the Democratic and Republican Party. And my fear is that by this time next year, Bernie Sanders is running around once again repeating this mantra of the least worst and stoking fears against whoever the Republican candidate is. And, you know, we've gone nowhere.
We've seen that routine before. You know, unfortunately, Dennis Kucinich had to toe the line. He was done by April. They even kept him out of some of the debates. And here he is, a loyal Democrat for years, Cleveland and the House of Representatives. Yeah, we've seen that. These progressive candidates, they're done by April, and then they're forced to produce a loyalty oath to whoever wins the nomination. And, of course, it's invariably the corporate Democrats. So, Steve, or David, what would you like to discuss with Chris?
Yeah, Chris, I have a question. Is that where the energy of the revolution will have to come from, the white middle class? Like the protests against the Vietnam War didn't really heat up until middle class white kids started getting drafted. Is that where that's going to have to come from?
It's an alliance. But, you know, the lower classes, if you look at kind of revolutions throughout history, are very problematic forces. Of course, Karl Marx despised them, the lumpen proletariats. He argued, I think correctly, that they are very susceptible to being recruited by what we would call, you know, conservative, right-wing, proto-fascist groups that are willing to give them a certain amount of empowerment and unleash them against dissidents and revolutionaries. I mean, this was a big dispute between Marx and Bakunin, but I think Bakunin's been proven right, that you need that conflation of what Bakunin calls these day class A intellectuals, those people who at one point thought that there was a place for them within the system. And both Davies and Brinton argue that revolutions are not caused by deprivation. They are caused when a large segment of the population, which had expectations about their role and their place in society, suddenly realized that those expectations will never be met. And I think that's why, at least in terms of revolutionary theory, the rise of these day class A intellectuals is so important to building a movement of resistance. And you're because right about the Vietnam War. That's exactly right.
Because the deprived poor, they're just trying to get through the day. They don't really have something to lose. They've lost almost everything. Where the middle class, when they're pushed down, they have something to lose, and enough of them can get angry throughout history to rise up and try to make a difference. But I don't think the theory of the lumpen proletariat really applies so much in this country. While we do have some virulent right-wing people who are in the lower economic middle class, I think that the majority of the poor in this country, people making under $25,000, $30,000 a year trying to raise a family, can become quite progressive, actually. I mean, they poll progressively, Hispanics, African Americans, even a lot of poor whites. But it is true that middle class people deprived are less risk averse than poor people just trying to get through the day to feed their families. Another question? David?
Yes. You know, we watch the Republicans feeding on each other and the left laughs, and yet the Republicans do very well. What would a liberal feeding frenzy look like in the Democratic Party? Why is the left so afraid of a vigorous debate?
Well, because the party is completely captive to corporate power. And I think Bernie has cut a kind of Faustian deal with the Democrats. And that's not even speculation, because I did an event with him and Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein and Shama Sawan in New York the night before the climate march. And Shama Sawan, the socialist city councilwoman from Seattle, and I asked him why he wouldn't run as a Democrat. And he said, because I don't want to end up like Nader. He didn't want to end up pushed out of the establishment. He wanted to keep his committee chairmanships. He wanted to keep his Senate seat. And he knew the forms of retribution and punishment that would be visited upon him if he applied his critique to the Democratic establishment, so he won't. The lie of omission is still a lie. And, you know, Bernie's decision to play the game with the Democratic Party and, in essence, lend credibility to the party and lend credibility to Hillary Clinton is very destructive. So a liberal feeding frenzy would see a rise of an actual liberal establishment within the party. I'm not sure one exists anymore, that challenged the party for selling out working men and women.
You know, but your point is even further documented by the retribution by the established Democratic Party against their left is pretty harsh, but not against their right. I mean, here's Senator Joe Lieberman. He goes and he endorses McCain at the Republican National Convention against Obama, and he comes back after Obama wins to Washington, and they give him a major chair of a major Senate committee and reinstate him. So anyway, we've been talking with Chris Hedges, the author of the new book, Wages of Rebellion, designed to inform, designed to galvanize you into redefining your role as a civic activist and civic leader. I've always believed that 1% or less of the people of this country, say 3 million people in congressional districts mobilizing for major redirections, can take on the Wall Street type 1% and prevail. How do people get in touch with you before we conclude, Chris? Give them your contact information.
Well, I have an email. That's it. I have no web page or Twitter or anything like that, but it's HedgesScoop, two S's, at AOL.com.
And your column appears when?
Every Monday on the website TruthDig.
TruthDig.com?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Chris. You have raised the ante in terms of what's necessary to change in this country through your many books, articles, speeches in North America. We'll stay in touch.
Thank you, Ralph.
And so say all of us. Thank you, Ralph, and thank you, Chris. Chris Hedges' new book is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. Thanks to RalphNaderRadioHour.com for the recorded audio. And once again, thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer, wishing you a pleasant what's left of the summer, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, and hoping you'll come back again next week. Ciao.